From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. A devastating side effect of radiation and chemotherapy can be infertility. A new state mandate now requires insurers to cover fertility preservation for cancer patients before they begin treatment. We speak to Brock Yetso, who heads the Omen Cancer Fund for Young Adults, and Sam Horn, who survived breast cancer. She says this coverage can bring peace of mind.
What I think is really important with fertility preservation is that we're ensuring that future and allowing patients to live in the present and fight their fight, go through chemo without having to worry about what's going to happen 5, 10, 15 years down the road.
And fertility specialist Dr. Mindy Christensen on how the technology of safeguarding fertility has advanced. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Those who survive cancer have overcome a life-threatening disease, but many face a different future than they might have dreamed of, one where having biological children is now difficult or impossible. Although cancer is the fourth leading cause of death for adolescents and young adults, the vast majority diagnosed with cancer survive. The long-term effects of treatment include increased risk of developing another form of cancer, heart and lung problems, and impaired fertility. Last week, Governor Hogan signed into law a bill requiring health insurance companies to provide cancer patients with coverage for fertility preservation, that is, collecting eggs or sperm, or protecting reproductive tissue and organs. Later, we'll hear how cancer and treating it can affect fertility from Dr. Molly Christensen, Assistant Professor of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Right now, I'm joined by Brock Yetso, President and CEO of the Omen Cancer Fund for Young Adults. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
And Samantha Horn, a patient navigator at the Omen Cancer Fund and a survivor of breast cancer. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Brock, what does the Omen Cancer Fund for Young Adults do?
Well, we are the oldest and largest nonprofit that is solely focused on the unique needs of young cancer patients and families. We were founded here in Maryland and have been advocating and supporting young adults that are facing cancer all over the country. And we do that by creating a community of support. And so within that community, there's programs, there's resources, and there's people that ensure that no young adult has to face cancer alone.
When did you start pushing for insurance coverage to protect the fertility of young patients?
So the actual process of advocating in our state capitol started about 2 years ago, but we like to say that this has been a journey that has been really going on for decades. You know, the organization is celebrating its 20th year, and from day one, we've been listening and responding to the unique needs of this population, and hearing that they were making or being forced to make really, really difficult decisions in a quick timeline. And one of those decisions was around how and if do we preserve our fertility prior to starting treatment. And so we heard that and you know, we educated ourselves more. We tried to support those issues and those needs with various programs, and they just ended up being Band-Aids. And so 2 years ago, we took that issue to some legislators in Annapolis and started to educate them about the need for change.
How much does fertility preservation cost? What is it you're asking the insurance companies to take on?
It varies. So for males, the initial process could be upwards of $1,500. And for females, it can be significantly more. We've spoken to patients and survivors that have gone through the process, and it's been on the low end, $8,000, and others have been upwards of $20,000. So the average is probably $10,000 to $12,000.
Have other states passed similar mandates?
They have. We're proud and excited that we are part of a movement. So Connecticut and Rhode Island were the first two states last year We're the third state in the country, so we're excited about that. And we believe here in Maryland, we are the healthcare capital of the country and perhaps the world. So we think it'll be momentum for other states to follow our lead. And there have been many other states that have issued legislation that is very similar to ours.
Sam, you were diagnosed with breast cancer at age 26. How did you find out you had cancer?
Just like a lot of other women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer, I found a lump. And just like a lot of young women and young people, it took me a long time to get a diagnosis. I found my lump when I was 26 in May of 2014. And I went to my doctor. They said, oh, it's just a lymph node. Don't worry about it unless it changes or hurts or grows. And I said, great. I went to four weddings that summer and started training for a 5K and went on a great vacation with friends. And then when I had to cut one of my training runs short because I had some pain, I was like, time to go back to the doctor. And at that point, my lump had grown to a point where the doctor could actually measure it with the little ruler that she had in her coat pocket. So from there, at this point, it's mid to late September. I had a biopsy on October 1st, and throughout the entire month of October of 2014, I saw two medical oncologists, two surgical oncologists, a radiation oncologist, and I had another biopsy, more tests, and test after test after test. Eventually, I had my full diagnosis of stage 2 breast cancer, and in this process, I also learned that I carried the BRCA1 genetic mutation, which puts me at a greater risk for not only breast cancer, but also ovarian cancer.
What a whirlwind.
Definitely.
So many decisions you were facing about your treatment, I presume about your job and career and time. And did you think about whether this had implications for your future ability to have children?
I did. And fortunately, the medical oncologists that I met with were pretty straightforward about it. They said that because I was young, it's possible that my fertility would bounce back, but it's also possible that it would not. So because it was kind of an if statement and a maybe, and it was this optional procedure that my insurance company did not cover, I chose to not preserve my fertility.
Was it primarily because of the expense?
That was a major role in it. I was 26 and financially independent, and I was working and had health insurance through my job, but I was still 26 and had a pretty tight budget and student loans. And one of the main things you hear about with cancer is people going broke. And I didn't want to go broke. I had goals. I wanted to buy a house. I wanted to do things with my life in the future beyond cancer. And $8,000, $10,000, $20,000 just wasn't really in it. It wasn't worth it to me.
And do you know how your cancer treatment affected your fertility?
No, I haven't had any sort of fertility testing or anything like that. I am still on a continued hormone therapy, and this is something that you see a lot of the time with breast cancer. So this is kind of an elongated treatment. I'm not in active treatment. I'm not in chemo. I have no evidence of disease. However, I am on some drugs that impact my hormones and not allowed to get pregnant, not allowed to try. So I haven't really looked into it very much. This type of treatment is encouraged for 5 to 10 years after treatment. And so currently I'm only 3 years. And some people do take a break, but that's just not for me personally.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Sam Horn, a breast cancer survivor and a patient navigator at the Ullman Cancer Fund, and with Brock Yetzo, president and CEO of the Ullman Cancer Fund for Young Adults. We're talking about a new mandate that goes into effect in January, requiring insurers in Maryland to give cancer patients the option to preserve their eggs or sperm. You are a patient navigator at the Ullman Cancer Fund. What does that mean?
Sure. It means that I meet with our young adult cancer patients in the cancer center, starting from as early as diagnosis, and I stay with them all the way through survivorship and beyond. So I think something that's really great about my role, and especially being at the hospital in a partnership with an external nonprofit is that I get to stay with the patients. I'm not confined to any one department within the hospital, so I'm with them from that first consult with a surgeon through chemotherapy with medical oncology or radiation with radiation oncology, and I can kind of see them no matter where they are in the process. And I also, through the programs that our organization provides, continue to work with them and meet with them through survivorship.
What do you hear from other survivors who face this decision about fertility?
I hear a few things from a number of young women that have chosen to preserve their fertility. They're on a very strict budget. Things are tight. They, you know, put a lot of money up front to pay for these expenses because it was important for them and the value is there. They do not regret their choices, but things are financially challenging. I also hear from patients who chose not to due to financial concerns that they have more concerns leading into the future. What I think is really important with fertility preservation is that we're ensuring that future and allowing patients to live in the present and fight their fight, go through chemo without having to worry about what's going to happen 5, 10, 15 years down the road.
Brock Yetso, what do you hear?
I hear many of the same things that Sam said. The other one is I hear of and so many survivors and patients came out to testify on behalf of this legislation, and I commend their bravery and their courage in going into a place that was dark and deep and sad. And so one of them I spoke with yesterday, who was with us with the governor, or last week, sorry, signing the bill, and she said it was bittersweet. It was bittersweet because she was not able to preserve because she did not have the finances, and this was over a decade ago. But yet she's so thankful that many families and patients moving forward will have that opportunity. You know, this is about choice. It's about a quality of life and a quality of care, and it's a fundamental right and opportunity for all of us to experience parenthood if we choose. And to take that away from you during a cancer diagnosis is just not fair. And so I think this is taking away a barrier that so many patients have had to experience for so many years.
Take me a little further along how you expect this to work now that health insurance will cover the cost of fertility preservation. What impact will that have?
It will make the decisions that patients have to make a little bit easier. We, as an organization, pride ourselves on meeting patients and families where they are. And Sam and her work as a navigator is a great example, meeting them on the front lines. And so we have been working now for over a decade on educating patients and institutions about the options of fertility preservation. And so that work, I think we're seeing the fruits of that labor, where more patients and families are asking those questions and seeking those resources. And what they've found is that there's a huge financial hurdle. And so I think this legislation now will take that away. And if they want to, they can move forward and preserve, whether it's a male or a female. And, you know, when they finish their treatment, they will have the opportunity to start a family if they'd like.
How many patients in Maryland face this each year?
So there's roughly 3,000 young men and women that are diagnosed with cancer in the state of Maryland. And that's about 10% of the population of people diagnosed with cancer in the state, which also mimics sort of national numbers. So based on our fiscal note within the legislation, there's upwards of at least 400 men and women that, based on usage rates, would certainly participate in this benefit. But it could be many more once the benefit is available to them.
How much is it expected to add to the overall insurance costs?
The cost will be minimal. I believe it's about 14 cents per beneficiary to insurance costs per year. So it is very minimal in the impact it'll have on us as Marylanders as well as insurance companies. And that was part of the due diligence the legislature did last year.
Maryland already has an insurance mandate that covers infertility treatment, like in vitro fertilization. So why was this additional coverage needed?
Well, that's a great point. And Maryland has been very progressive on many fronts with healthcare. And many of the legislators believe this was just an extension of that benefit. And the reason it's needed is because although you're getting IVF covered when you're infertile, if you're a cancer patient, your eggs perhaps could be 15 years aged from the chemotherapy or the radiation you got. So you can have that benefit to move forward with IVF coverage, but that doesn't guarantee that IVF is actually going to work. And oftentimes we see many, many patients, or have heard of many patients that would move forward with an IVF treatment several times at the cost of insurance companies in our state. And so now we believe this is almost a proactive benefit that will reduce the amount of IVF procedures they'll have to go through to experience parenthood.
Thank you both for telling us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Sheila.
Brock Yetso is president and CEO of the Ullman Cancer Fund for Young Adults. Sam Horn is a patient navigator at the Ullman Cancer Fund and a cancer survivor. Short break here on The Record. When we come back, how can cancer treatment impact your fertility, both long-term and short-term? We'll hear from an expert in fertility. I'm Sheila Katz. This is On The Record. Stay with us.
This is the On The Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On The Record. I'm Sheila Kast. Among the tolls levied by cancer, that its treatment can render patients unable to have children, and the cost of fertility preservation can amount to thousands of dollars, out of reach for many juggling the cost of cancer treatment. Last week, Maryland adopted a mandate requiring health insurers to add coverage so patients have the option to preserve eggs or sperm before they begin treatment for cancer. The Maryland Healthcare Commission estimates the added insurance cost will be less than a quarter per member per month. Earlier, we heard from a cancer survivor and the director of the Ullman Cancer Fund for Young Adults. With us now is Dr. Mindy Christensen, an assistant professor in the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, part of the Department of Gynecology and Obstetrics at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
How do cancer treatments affect fertility?
So cancer treatment affects fertility in various ways, really depending on the type of treatment, the type of chemotherapy, and then for women, the age of the patient and her current egg supply. But there are many chemotherapy cancer treatments as well as radiation that can essentially render a patient infertile.
Are radiation and chemotherapy equally damaging to fertility?
Radiation can actually be more damaging depending on where it's targeted, and then certain types of chemotherapy, certain classifications of chemotherapy can be very damaging to the ovary.
So what does preservation entail?
So fertility preservation, there's different types of fertility preservation depending on the patient and her needs. I deal mostly with female patients, so I'll be talking mostly about freezing eggs and freezing embryos. But there's really three classes of fertility preservation for females. There's freezing embryos, which is considered the gold standard. We've been freezing embryos for many, many years, and it's very successful as far as resulting in pregnancy. There's freezing eggs, which was considered experimental until 2012. Freezing eggs is actually technically much more difficult than freezing embryos. And there's actually also freezing ovarian tissue, which is still considered experimental, and it's an emerging technology.
Okay, freezing embryos would work if your patient is already in a relationship or
right.
You need a fertilized egg
right.
to do that.
For some, yes, exactly. You need to have a partner or be willing to use a sperm donor.
Uh-huh. And you said freezing eggs is technically more difficult.
It is. The egg is actually the largest cell in the human body, so it has the most fluid, so ice crystals can form. And so initially, it was very difficult to freeze eggs because the ice crystals would form and actually damage the DNA in the egg. But then a new type of freezing called vitrification was developed, which is a flash freezing of the eggs. And now it's actually very successful.
And so that would be an option for any woman who's not in a relationship doesn't have embryos to freeze.
Right. Freezing eggs is an option for a female who wants to preserve her fertility as long as she started to have periods already. So freezing eggs is not an option for a pediatric patient who hasn't started puberty yet or hasn't started to have periods for a female. For that type of patient, the only option is freezing ovarian tissue. But otherwise, for young women who don't have a partner but have started puberty, freezing eggs is an option.
So freezing ovarian tissue, I can't begin to imagine what that is or how that preserves fertility. How does that work?
So freezing ovarian tissue, like I mentioned before, is still considered experimental. There's been about 130 live births to date that we know of from freezing ovarian tissue worldwide, but it actually involves harvesting ovarian tissue through a surgical procedure, usually a laparoscopy, and the tissue is frozen, and in the future, that tissue can be thawed and transplanted back into the patient to help her achieve a pregnancy.
So the ovarian tissue would include eggs?
Yeah. So in the ovarian tissue, in the what's called the ovarian cortex, which is the outside of the egg, it harbors hundreds of thousands of what we call primordial follicles, which are actually immature eggs. So in that ovarian tissue are thousands of eggs.
The law covers standard fertility preservation procedures. There's an experimental procedure involving ovaries. Is that what we've been talking about?
Right. So I was talking about freezing ovarian tissue, which is still considered experimental. And so insurance companies don't cover that because it's considered experimental. But they will cover, from what I understand, they will now cover freezing embryos and freezing oocytes.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Dr. Mindy Christensen, an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and an expert on infertility. We're talking about how cancer treatment impacts fertility and how patients can preserve eggs or sperm to ensure their options for the future. How often do you see patients who are about to start cancer treatment?
At our center, we see about 2 to 3 patients per week who are about to start cancer treatment who are interested in fertility preservation.
And is it your impression that this is a conversation that most oncologists, most cancer doctors are having with patients before they start treatment?
I will say it appears that it's becoming more and more common. There's been early research that has showed a lot of patients weren't being offered fertility preservation, but the rate of fertility preservation consultations in our clinic has increased exponentially over the last 10 years. And so it's becoming more and more of an option, and more oncologists are discussing this with patients and at least making sure they have the option to consider fertility preservation. I think that being diagnosed with cancer is very stressful, and there's a lot of things that women are concerned about at the time they're diagnosed. And having to worry about how they're going to pay for fertility preservation, I've seen many, many times, is very, very stressful. And I've unfortunately seen patients unable to go through fertility preservation, even though having children in the future was very important due to lack of financial means to pay for it, even though we do have organizations and ways to help them. And so I think that this mandate will greatly help patients in the future have access to fertility preservation. And we do know that fertility preservation is a very key survivorship issue, and having a family is very important to women. So this is something that's very important.
Do men and women face the same rate of infertility from cancer treatment?
So male and females, they can face the same rate. Once again, it depends on the type of cancer and the age of the patient and the type of treatment.
Are there situations in which steps for fertility preservation might make cancer treatment less effective?
So we would never offer a patient a fertility preservation treatment option if it was going to impair her cancer treatment. So this is a discussion we would have with the oncologist, and we work together as a team to help come up with the best plan. The issue with fertility preservation treatment is that it is about a 2-week process. And so a patient would need to delay her treatment 2 to 3 weeks in order to harvest eggs for either freezing eggs or embryos.
For women who have had breast cancer that is impacted by levels of hormones, how does that affect their options about pregnancy?
So breast cancer patients are actually a very common group of patients we see for fertility preservation. Most breast cancer patients actually have a window for fertility preservation. The majority of patients we see have had their surgery and then have a 6 weeks window before they start their chemotherapy. As far as whether the fertility preservation can be harmful for these patients, we need to be very cognizant of the fact that many patients are estrogen receptor positive. And when we do these fertility treatments, it can raise the estrogen levels. We actually do have special protocols where we can add medications called aromatase inhibitors to actually decrease the estrogen levels during the treatment.
But are such patients then, after cancer treatment, do they need to hold off getting pregnant?
So some breast cancer patients are recommended by their oncologist to delay childbearing for several years, and this is a conversation the patient herself will have with the oncologist. Many women are on a class of a medication called estrogen blockers to help decrease their risk of recurrence. And it used to be 5 years, and now it's 10 years that many patients are on these medications. Many women don't want to wait 5 to 10 years to have a child, so they can look at options such as using a gestational carrier, or they can work together with their oncologist to decide the best time for them to attempt pregnancy.
I appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Mindy Christensen is an assistant professor in the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, part of the Department of Gynecology and Obstetrics at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.